When I was 16 years old, I crashed my cousin's car into a tree on her wedding day. Yeah, I felt pretty lousy about that. And I would have done anything to make it up to her, anything to redeem myself. Thankfully, my uncle helped me redeem myself. He went and got the little light that I had broken and helped me fix it and showed me how to buff out the scratches. It wasn't too bad, but boy, I hate the feeling of having to make up for something I've done wrong, of having to redeem myself. Have you ever felt like you needed to redeem yourself? Maybe make up for something you'd done wrong or something you failed to do? It's not a great feeling. You may not use that word, redemption, very often, but it is a part of the fabric of our world, that's for sure. It's in all of our books, stories, movies, TV shows. All of them are filled with stories of people who needed to redeem themselves for some reason or another. It's in politics. It's in sports, for sure. People who need to come back from some failure or some mistake and redeem themselves. And the tragic stories are the people who never get to redeem themselves or who refuse. It's not easy to redeem yourself in this world. It's really difficult. And it gets even harder when you realize there is a God who created us and who loves us. And we have, in horrible ways, offended him by not loving him and by not being who he created us to be. That's probably one of the more difficult things to deal with. How do you redeem yourself in God's eyes when you haven't loved him, when you're not who he created you to be, when you're not like him, the way he created you to be? You know, we're talking about God who knows everything you've ever done, even the things you've tried to forget or have forgotten. He knows everything you've ever said. He knows everything you've ever thought. How do you redeem yourself in the eyes of someone who sees everything about you? Every mistake and failure you've ever made, how do you redeem yourself in his eyes? The good news about Easter. Why Easter is a celebration that's not just once a year, but all year round, is that at Easter and all year round, we remember that Jesus came and lived and died so that it would be possible for all of us to be redeemed. That's what makes this such a wonderful season to focus on and think about how Jesus has redeemed us and hopefully get it deep into our hearts so we don't forget what it is he's done when we get to July or August and vacation time, hopefully, right? But to do that, we want to understand what redemption is because there are many facets to redemption. There are different aspects to it. And the more we dig in and the closer we look at it, the more we learn about it, the more it transforms our hearts, the more it changes us and gives us new life. And so what we've been doing, we started last week, is we're looking at this word redemption and the different aspects of it. Last week, we talked about how Jesus redeems us by rescuing us. He rescued us from the curse of thinking that we could redeem ourselves by working hard enough or obeying the right rules or enough rules, right? He redeemed us from the curse of thinking that we could redeem ourselves or feeling like we have to redeem ourselves. Those ways of thinking are a curse, and Jesus rescued us from those ways of thinking. Today, I want to talk about and focus on how redemption is ransom because a price was paid for you and for me. And we need to understand that. Try and think of the best story, the biggest story of ransom you've ever heard, right? Not a movie, not, you know, Taken or Taken 2 or Taken 3. No, a real life story of someone who was kidnapped and ransomed. Depending on how old you are, a lot of you are thinking of a story that rocked our country right when I was a really, really little boy, the story of Patty Hearst. Patty Hearst was the heiress to a great fortune that her grandfather had amassed. He built a media empire, the Hearst Media Empire. And when she was just a college girl, in her dorm room, this essentially domestic terror group ran into her dorm room, took her hostage, and blindfolded her. And for weeks on end, she never got to see who was holding her captive. They just kept her blindfolded or locked in a closet all the time. And they demanded first ransom. This was a violent group willing to hurt and kill people. The first thing they wanted was for her grandfather to use his influence to get a couple of their members free who'd been thrown in prison. Well, that didn't work out. And so they arranged for a certain ransom to be paid, and it was done. But the thing that captivated everyone in our country about this story was that when the moment came for her to maybe be able to go free, she chose to stay with her kidnappers. She didn't just choose to stay with them. She chose to join them. In fact, there's video of her helping them rob a bank, walking in with a rifle and pointing it at people. And there's witnesses who talked about another time she was helping them rob another place, and she shot bullets at people who were trying to capture and arrest some of her teammates, her gang mates, or whatever you call them. Right? She helped make bombs. She even helped kidnap a couple other people. Like, she just completely gave herself over to this group and chose to stay with the people who were holding her hostage. Right around that same time in history, the name Stockholm Syndrome came into popular use. It was this idea that someone who was kidnapped and held hostage would start to identify with the people holding them and even might choose to help them in some way. And so even though ransoms were paid, her mind was so twisted and confused that she chose to stay with the people who had kidnapped her. Well, how do you ransom someone's mind? This morning, I want to focus on a passage of scripture written by the Apostle Peter, who talks about how Jesus has ransomed us, not just physically, but also from a way of life, a way of seeing and thinking about life. So if you have your Bible there, turn to 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 18 through the beginning of verse 19. I'm going to put it on the screen here too, but here's what it says. It says, "For you know that it was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, that you were ransomed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Christ." Peter makes at least a couple things really clear here in these two short verses. One, we are being held hostage by a way of thinking and a way of perceiving life. And two, there is a price that must be paid to ransom us out of captivity to that way of life and thinking. So what is it? What is it that's holding us hostage? He calls it an empty way of life that we've inherited generation to generation to generation to generation. It's so strong in us that we don't even realize that it's just, this is how life is. And so we keep living it this way, assuming this is just the way it's supposed to be. A lot of you have probably heard the story about the grandmother with her meatloaf. She makes meatloaf, and every time before she serves it, she cuts the ends off and then serves it without the ends, just throws them out. And then her daughter, when her daughter gets older and has her own family and makes her own meatloaf, she does the same thing. Before she serves it, she cuts the two ends off, throws them away, and then serves the meatloaf. And then her daughter, when she gets old enough and has her own family, she, whenever she makes meatloaf, cuts the ends off before she serves it. And no one questions why they're doing this. They just do it, because this is what we do. This is how you serve meatloaf. Until one day, finally, someone said something and asked, "Why are you cutting the ends off?" And they didn't know. So someone went back to the grandmother and said, "You know, Grandma, we've all learned to make meatloaf from you, and it's the best meatloaf in the world, but why do we cut the ends off?" And the grandmother kind of laughed at them and said, "Well, I cut the ends off because the pan I made the meatloaf in was bigger than the tray I served the meatloaf in, so I didn't want the meatloaf hanging over the edges, so I would cut the ends off." And so for all those years, they were cutting off the ends and throwing them away for no reason. They didn't know why. They just had inherited it. And that's what Peter's talking about here. You may not even be aware of the things, you probably aren't, of the things you've inherited from your parents and from the culture around us, right? At some point, your parents aren't as much of an influence on you as the culture, and we just inherit a way of life. Depending on where we're growing up and when we're growing up and what's happening around us, we kind of just inherit it and absorb it, and then we live that way. And maybe some of us expand our horizons. Maybe you make friends with a diverse group of people, and that expands your cultural understanding. Or maybe you travel the world and you get some more experience with other cultures, and that broadens you. But really what's happening is you're just learning other people's ways of life that they have just handed down from generation to generation to generation. And this is just life as far as we know it. This is how life goes. But there is supposed to be so much more to life than what we've inherited from our parents and their parents and their parents. There's so much about life that we're missing. Let me try and illustrate it this way. Imagine that you'd never seen an actual house, right? I don't know why you're living outside all the time. Houses don't exist. But what do exist are drawings of houses. You know what? Let me do this real quick. I'm going to just draw a picture of a house real fast to hold up here. All right? So just imagine you've never seen a house before. All you ever see are drawings on paper of houses that people might show you. They're imagining, oh, wouldn't it be nice if there was something that existed like this? And so they do these drawings of houses, but they're always just two-dimensional, flat, on paper. You know, they have height and they have width, but they have no depth. They're not real houses. They're just pictures of houses. So you take a house and you draw it something like this, and, you know, I'll let you see. Look how great I draw. I hope you believe that I drew that. So you take this picture of a house, and if that's all you know, then imagine when the day comes and someone brings you to an actual house that's been built in three dimensions. And instead of just looking at it on some silly piece of paper, you are able to walk inside and go from room to room and experience the ceilings and the staircases and the windows and the doorways and the furniture and all the different pieces. Your mind would be blown away by it. It would be so different than anything you'd ever known, because all you'd ever known was this two-dimensional drawings of houses. It just wouldn't compare. And now imagine someone offered you, said, here, you can either have this drawing of a house, or I'll give you a real three-dimensional house that's been built, a real house. Like, which would you choose? Even if they offered you the greatest drawing of the most amazing house in the world, right, but it's only a drawing on paper in two dimensions, would you choose that, or would you choose even an average house that was actually a house built in three dimensions? Full size, full scale, human living house. You wouldn't choose this house. This is garbage compared to a real house, compared to walking around in the rooms and experiencing it. That's what it's like. That's what Jesus does for us. Two-dimensional drawings of houses are empty. They don't even compare to three-dimensional houses. Neither will the way of life that we've inherited from generation to generation to generation compare to the way of life that Jesus is building for us. It's that big a difference. It's like going from two-dimensional to three-dimensional. But someone's got to pay the price to take a house from a two-dimensional drawing and turn it into a real three-dimensional home. Someone's got to pay the price to do that. And that's what Jesus wants to do for us. The problem is this way of life holds us hostage, and it requires a price to break us free from it. And that price is death. We're held hostage by sin and death and the grave. And they demand a price on our lives. And they're hungry for life. They consume life. And nothing will satisfy sin and death and the grave other than life. And you can't pay that ransom. Psalm 49, verse 8 says, "The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough." You know, imagine a movie scene where a guy gets kidnapped and they blindfold him, toss him in a van, drive him to their lair, tie him to a chair. And then he says, what do you want with me? What do you want? And they say, we want a ransom. He says, tell me how much, whatever it is. I'll pay everything I've got. And they say, we want your life. My life? Well, if I give you my life, then I'm dead. What's the point? That's the price. If you want to be set free, it's going to cost you your life. Do you recognize the situation we're in and how dire it is? Because that's the situation we're in. The best we could offer to ransom our lives would be our lives. But then we'd be losing the very thing we were trying to save. But that's what's demanded. Nothing that's perishable, Peter says. Not silver or gold or anything that perishes. And silver or gold are two of the things on earth that are least likely to perish. But they're not eternal. The price to get out of this hostage situation we're in, where our minds are captive, is life, our lives. Whose life could be so valuable that it would be enough to satisfy not just for you or me, but for all of us? Whose life but God's life? Whose life but Jesus' life? Because he's our creator, because he's the one who loves us and made us. And Jesus willingly gave his life to ransom you and me, to buy us out of this empty way of living. That's what Jesus has done. So Jesus gave his life, gave himself over to sin and death in the grave, and the grave swallowed him up. And Peter, listen, I want you to listen to how Peter describes this. In the very first sermon Peter ever preached, on the day of Pentecost, the feast in Jerusalem, it was after Jesus had died, and it was soon after he had risen, ascended into heaven. And so Peter and the disciples had been waiting, and Jesus poured out the Holy Spirit on them. And then Peter gets up in the middle of Jerusalem and the crowds of thousands around him, and he starts to tell them the truth about Jesus and what they had just done. And this is part of what he says to them. He says, "This man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death," listen to this part now, "because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him." Jesus paid the ransom. He paid it. Death and the grave got what they wanted. They took Jesus' dead body, and they took it from the cross, and they placed it in the gaping mouth of that grave carved out of the rock. And the grave gorged itself on Jesus' dead body. And it was full, and it was satisfied. But then something began to happen. Something didn't feel right deep in the guts of death and the grave. Kind of like what happens to us when we're scrounging whatever we can find in our fridges together because we don't want to go to the store and maybe it doesn't sit right. Something was going on inside the depths of the grave and death, because what happened was death bit off more than it could chew, and the grave swallowed more than it could hold, and out burst Jesus alive again on that third day. That's what Jesus has done. Jesus paid the ransom, but then he defeated and destroyed death. That's why you and I have this confidence that goes beyond the death and the grave, right? That's our confidence, is in that what Jesus did that day. He paid the ransom, but he also overcame death and the grave. He paid the price, but he destroyed death. And so we've been ransomed. And more than that, we've been given a hope for a life that is beyond anything we've ever known before, than the life we've inherited from everyone who's come before us. We've been given the opening, the way in. We've been ransomed to come back and experience a life that is completely different. It's like we were two-dimensional beings, all of a sudden being drawn into a third dimension and seeing depth for the first time ever. We've been brought into a new life where we can experience the dimensions of God's sovereign realm. And that is an amazing place to live. Now we have new purpose and new life that's not flat. It's full, and it's a life that's worth living. Really is. You know, reminds me of a story I read the other day Some people like to go antiquing. I am definitely not one of them, but my wife does. So I'll go along once every 10 years. And I just stand there, but she looks around. And what do you do when you go antiquing? You look for a treasure, something that's more valuable than the price tag that's on it. You know, maybe you get lucky and find something like that. But I read this story about a collector, a guy who collected fine pottery. And he was an expert in finding fine pottery in antique shops and places where people didn't realize what they had. And so he walked into an antique store one day and through the cloud of smoke, because standing there behind the counter was the owner just smoking cigarette after cigarette after cigarette, not even paying any attention to this guy as he wandered around looking, hoping to find that rare find, that precious, valuable thing. And after he rummaged around for a while and got to the point where he couldn't handle the smell of the smoke anymore, he started to leave, and he walked by the owner to, you know, say goodbye. And he noticed the bowl that the guy was using for his ashtray. It was a huge bowl that he was just knocking the cigarette ashes off into, and it was full of cigarette ash and all kinds of garbage, and it was nasty and dirty. But he immediately recognized that that bowl was a precious work of art. It was an incredibly valuable piece of porcelain work that should be at a museum, not in some antique shop with some knucklehead knocking his cigarette ashes into it. And so he said, "Hey, I want to buy your ashtray." And the owner said, "Sure, okay." So he sold it to him, and the guy took it home, and he spent days and days cleaning it and polishing it and restoring it back to its original beauty again. And then he put a couple ornamental pieces inside of it, the way it was designed to be used. And he set it up there on the mantle in his home, the center of everything, to just to have life again and beauty again. And he redeemed that bowl to its purpose, to a life with purpose, much greater than just carrying the wasted ashes of some antique shop owner. Now imagine if a couple weeks went by and he got a phone call from that antique shop owner. And the guy said, "You know, I really miss that ashtray I sold you a couple weeks ago. It was just great. It was so big. I never missed. You know, I want to buy it back." What do you think the collector would say? He'd say, "No way. Get out of here. It was precious. I redeemed it. I restored it. I took that filthy, dirty bowl that you had ruined, and I cleaned out every little part of it, every ornamental piece, every little nook and cranny. I cleaned that thing out. I redeemed it. I brought it back to all of its beauty, what it was created to be. And now it's serving its proper place as a beautiful piece of art that inspires anyone who sees it. There's no way I'm going to sell this thing back to you." Jesus paid your ransom with his blood. There is no way he would ever sell you back. But the question this morning is, what will you do? Knowing what Jesus spent to ransom you, what will you do? Will you go back to the ideas and ways of living, the flat ways of living that held you hostage? Or will you embrace this new life in the divine dimensions of God's realm? What will you do with what Jesus has done for you? You know, where might you be tempted to use this life that God has given you for something less than what he called you to be? Where are you tempted to go back to being an ashtray, wasting your life away, abusing your body, abusing your mind? Where are you tempted? Where are you tempted back to an empty way of life, just a flat way of life? Because it's what you've always known and it's comfortable. Where are you tempted back to things that maybe have held you hostage, habits, addictions? If you feel yourself being drawn there, then I want to pray for you today. If you feel yourself stuck, like you're being held hostage by old ways of thinking that you just can't shake, and they just don't make sense, but you won't let them go, I want to pray for you. If you aren't experiencing how precious and amazing and purposeful your life is because you've woken up, because Jesus woke you up, and you're now seeing the divine dimensions of life, not just the flat life that was handed down to you that you knew all your life, but now you're starting to see it all in these multi-dimensions that God has opened up for you. If you don't feel that, then I want to pray for you this morning. I want to pray that we experience the results of this ransom Jesus paid for us, how he's brought us into this new life. Let's just pray. Father, Lord, I pray that we wouldn't run back to our kidnappers, that we wouldn't run back to flat ways of viewing life and living life. Lord, I pray that we would ask you this morning to forgive our sin. Forgive us for not loving you, Lord, for not being what you created us to be. And Lord, some of us are stuck. We're being held hostage, and we need to be set free. So Lord Jesus, I pray this morning you would set us free. And I pray that we would never go back. I pray instead that we would discover all these new dimensions to life that you've opened up for us, and that we would realize that life is truly and absolutely worth living because Jesus.